aften og velkommen til Radio Shalom. Vi sender på 87,6 på FM-båndet og på 90,6 på hybrid. Radio Shalom sender hver aften mandag til torsdag fra klokken 18:30 til 20. Hver tredje onsdag sender vi på Yiddish. Lørdag aften klokken 22 til 24 sender vi musik. Søndag formiddag klokken 10 til 12 sender vi ugens magasin. Og søndag klokken 16 til 20 sender vi på hebraisk. Og man kan få meget mere at vide om Radio Shalom ved at gå ind på hjemmesiden. Den hedder www.radioshalom.dk. Og herfra kan man også lytte til udsendelserne, enten via en kategori eller en dato. Og her på Radio Shalom vil vi altid gerne høre fra lytterne. Enten så kan man sende os en mail. Her er adressen info@radioshalom.dk. Eller også kan man ringe til studiet. Telefonnummeret her er 35 85 86 11.
Dagens program indeholder følgende. Først har vi gæst i studiet, Camilla Dombrovska, som fortæller om Polin, det jødiske museum i Warszawa. Miriam Schechter interviewer, og det er på engelsk. Til sidst, Anders Jerichos tale ved årets kristallnat arrangement i København, samt musik, der blev spillet ved denne lejlighed.
Well, my guest today in the studio, and welcome, is Camilla Dombrovska, a PhD and manager of the guide unit in the Museum Polin, the Polish Jewish Museum in Warsaw. And you are here to collect and prepare and maybe even the making the PR work for your next program, which is the commemoration of the event of the 1968, the expulsion of the Jews of Poland. The Danish public knows them, those who came to Denmark as refugees. Welcome again to Radio Shalom. I'm very happy to have you here in the studio.
Thank you for inviting. Thank you.
My pleasure. It's very interesting from those who have Polish roots and those who interest are in the refugees at the time of 68, to know how the Polish Museum will deal with it. Mm-hmm. To begin with, maybe I will ask you to just give a kind of an impression. What is the Museum Polin in Warsaw? Mm-hmm.
So, as you know, we are open already for 2 years, almost 2 years, as we officially opened in November 2014. So it has been 2 years of public exposition of the museum. The museum deals with 1,000 years of the Polish Jewish history, the history of Polish Jews exactly. So it starts in the early Middle Ages, telling the story of the 1,000 years of the presence of the Jews in Poland, trying to present it in the broader context, in the confrontation with the majority group of Poles, which naturally interact in between the Jews and Poles. So the story starts in early Middle Ages and it does not end. As the last exhibit tells the story after the Holocaust, continuing into the present time, presenting the contemporary Jewish community in Poland as it is now in Warsaw and in other towns in Poland. So the core exhibit is divided into thematic galleries, which respond more or less into the periods, historical periods. And each period somehow links with the previous and with the next, so you can have your own path linking the particular points and the galleries. Otherwise, you might go either by yourself, either using an audio guide, either with the help of a guide. We have also thematic tours, so you can choose a path related with women, Jewish women in Poland, or in not in Poland, but in those territories within the 1,000 years. Or you might choose a path related with highlights, either a historical one, either the thematic ones. So more or less it's part of the exhibit, but otherwise we are a huge, relatively huge institution, as we have now 150 employees, and we have an extended program of additional activities related but also not related with the core exhibit. It's a huge cultural program, huge educational program, and really big academic program. So there are different layers of the museum, not only that one related with the core exhibit and the temporary exhibits as well. So it's a big institution dealing with a lot of audience, and within a year we have more or less 500,000 of visitors only visiting core exhibit, and a few hundred thousands also attend our different programs. As, for example, the big audience are Polish schools, which come for the educational classes related with the topics, of course, of the core exhibit, but not only, as we are also dealing with anti-discrimination issues, tolerance, or broader issues which are more contemporary related with the, you know, contemporary society.
Well, it sounds both interesting, very impressive, and very huge, big museum.
It is.
It's supposed to be the biggest Jewish museum in Europe right now. Am I correct? Is my information correct?
I think it's one of the biggest. I don't know whether it's, but probably in case of visitors and in case of the core exhibit and the building, it's one of the biggest.
And the building has received an architectural prize as well?
Yes.
Which is very beautiful to know.
Yes, and very we got great. Two prizes for the best museums in Europe. So we are recognized as one of the best museums now.
Well, let me compliment you on it, because during 2 years to achieve that is very, very nice. Very,
thank you.
Yes, indeed. I've worked with museums before too, so I know during 2 years it's a wonderful achievement. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. I will pass for sure to our
Yes, please do that. You know, I'm personally with my Polish roots, I'm very happy to know. I was very happy when I got to know it. I'm still very happy to know this institution is working on very important issues, because, as you say yourself, we've been there for 1,000 years as Jewish citizens, part of the Polish culture. What I didn't hear from your description yet was one word of anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
Is this an issue that you take up? You say you have issues about, you have a program about discrimination and women issues maybe too, but I didn't hear this word. And this word is for me a very important and central role in my relations to Poland.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How do you deal with it at your museum?
It's important to claim that the exhibit presents all scope of relations. So, in simplifying the description, the good and the bad ones as well. So the history is presented as it happened, not covering, not exposing any particular issue, but you as a visitor, you see the broad scope of it. And of course it has of the dark and the bright sides. And it depends what do you want to find in that exhibit. You might find whatever you are looking for. So there are, of course, issues related with anti-Semitism, negative attitudes towards Jews within those 1,000 years. But aside of that, you have also the other side. So the daily life, which was not always bad. It had also bright sides, and also presenting how Jews influence into the Polish culture and how the Polish culture influenced the Jewish culture. As for the educational issues, we do not, of course, avoid that issue, but it's introduced into the wider scope, not to expose only one point, because it does not show then the broad scope of the relations. But we are not avoiding it in any kind of our activities. And of course, if you consider, for example, the public discussion, we touch also the difficult issues. So pogroms, the difficult and complicated relations during the war, the post-war issues. So depending what kind of aspect you as a visitor are looking for, you might find it within our program, but also, of course, in the exhibit as well.
When you make plans for an exhibition, or when you make plans for the common exhibitions, like the program that you represent, how much do you take into consideration what the public could say or react on? How much responsibility do you feel or take care of when you build an exhibition? Because the public reaction, I assume, is not always positive when it is the Jewish issue, like any other place in the world, not especially Poland, like anywhere else in the world.
So you have to consider two facts, that if we speak about March 68, for example, as it's one of the temporary exhibits we are preparing, it's not the closest one, but it will come soon. For the broad Polish public, as we speak, because most of our visitors, we have to underline it, are Poles. So even though there are many Jewish visitors coming mainly from United States and Israel, as we have 15,000 Israelis coming each year, which is a huge number as
for an exhibition, museum.
Yes. For a museum, it's a really huge number. And I think it's our success that the Israelis come and see the exhibit, not only the concentration camps. So they have the broader view how this complicated story look like.
Sure.
But for example, but as our main public is Polish, you have to have it somewhere back in your mind that you have to present it in the way they will understand it. So if you present just one side of the story, for example, March 68, they will not understand it. As for them, March 68 is not anymore, it's not an issue for them, because they are not taught on that in schools, or if so, only in really narrow scale. So for the younger generation, for schools, March 68 is not an issue. Most of the young Poles do not know that it was the last expulsion of Jews from Poland. They consider March 68 as the riots of young people, students. It's a huge deal how to tell a story which finds itself in a knowledge vacuum that you do not find any relation to, neither in school curriculum nor in their own experience. Yeah. It's an issue. So how to introduce a topic which is completely not relevant to your own experience and your own knowledge, and then to present it in such a complicated way as it was, right?
So the narrative you're trying to build is always a narrative that is a careful one.
I would not say that...
Because as I understood from you right now, is that the history is not put, I will call it, not in a kaleidoscope, for the younger people. It's only a small issue. Maybe they heard about it, maybe they didn't hear about it at all. So it's actually like walking very carefully on a path of, I don't know, not very easy task for you then.
It's not an easy task, because you have to, how to say, find a hook that you can relate to and then build a story. Otherwise, you really do not have a basis to build on, right? So first you have to have something that they will refer to, their own stories, their family story. Then you can build a wider story presenting the mechanism, the story itself. Otherwise, it might close in a bubble, like, okay, it was the past, a group, something bizarre happened to them, and they were expelled. And of course, you have to have it in the back of your mind, that to have it understood, you have to relate to something which is close to your own soul, your experience, your family experience. So that's why when the guides are guiding, they're asking the same simple questions at the beginning. Where do you come from? Which city? And then when they guide through the exhibit, they say, you see, that's the city you are coming from. There was a Jewish community. The Jewish community existed there in the period of. And then something opens in their own mind that they were their neighbors some time ago. And that's the way to build the story for the people who really, it's 50 years for most of the Poland where the Jewish communities, they do not exist. So we have few generations already which do not remember
and weren't told about it.
weren't told about it, or if they are told, it's what Poland has done within last 20 years. It's a lot of work in bringing back the memory, not easy one. It started long time before Gross with the publications related with the Holocaust, but it did happen that it opened a discussion. And that discussion, of course, was vivid at the end of 90s, after the Gross publications, beginning of 2000. But then it opened the discussion on the local levels, that you started to have activists which try to take care of cemeteries. You have schools which take part in the programs related with Jewish history. It's a phenomenon. Why a Polish kid should care about somebody they have not even seen? Because of most of them, they have never seen a Jew. Mm-hmm. Yes. They have not even seen the cemetery, because the cemetery was destroyed long time before they were born. And how to explain them the complexity of the issues related with that?
Good question. Not only in Poland, unfortunately. Yes. We'll have a little bit of an interruption here, and we'll have music. If we could get our technician to take care of us. So I don't know what. Yes, can we have an abruption here, and we'll have music, please. Well, in my studio is my guest from Poland, Kamila Dąbrowska, which is the manager of the guide tours in the Museum Polin in Warsaw. How does the fact that there is such a museum now in Warsaw, how does it affect the town itself? In which way?
Mm-hmm. It became one of the highlights, of the city highlights, as I think it's the third most visited museum in Warsaw, by the Polish groups coming from all over the Poland and by foreigners. So it is an important part on the cultural and museum map of Warsaw, both in that sense as a tourist attraction, but also as a place which influences the discussion, takes part in the discussion, creates a place for interaction and changing the
views. What kind of interaction?
For example, we have different discussion, as we mentioned at the beginning, and sometimes they touch the delicate issues related with anti-Semitism, Polish-Jewish relation with in particular period, and there are different people coming to listen to it, and that's, you know, the museum itself functions as a place to create and to influence the public discussion on different issues.
Now, is there an interaction between the other museums in the cultural field, which what I'm thinking of is, Jews have been contributing to Polish culture in nearly all fields of art, literature, music, theater, film, you name it. I mean, they have been so integrated in the Polish culture regarding the artistic path. In the Historical Museum of Warsaw, where I've been, in the Museum of the Castle, all the places where there is art, where there is an opportunity to show the Jewish contribution, is it done?
I think it is somehow the place for the temporary exhibits, as we had Frank Stella. I think it was not the the previous exhibit we had. Frank Stella is one of the most recognized abstract artists. So museum created an exhibit for such a widely recognized contemporary artist. So I think it was a huge event, not only for a Jewish museum, but also for the cultural institution itself. Otherwise, we have programs of residencies, artistic residencies. So we invite artists for a month or 2 months, stay in the museum, and they can create their own artistic ideas, different ones. Some
are these artists Polish artists, or are they?
They're both Jewish,
but from Poland. Polish?
No. We had, I think, the last one was an Israeli young artist whose father left Poland in 56, and she created artistic performance on the basis of her father's experiences.
Very interesting.
So that's what we do, for example. So different artists, there are particular criteria and everybody can apply. We do not look whether he's Jewish, Polish, Argentinian. It depends on the project he or she wants to present, for example. And for example, in our coming temporary exhibit, it will be an exhibit on blood. It was an exhibit which was presented in a Jewish museum in London, and we adapt that exhibition to our
premises.
And one part of the exhibit will be also contemporary art related with blood itself. So the artists are invited to create their own artistic
expressions
pieces.
Yes. Or contribution by blood as a theme to the event.
Yes. So you are kindly invited. We will open it. The next temporary exhibit will be on music, Jewish music, and it's an exhibit which was previously shown in Hohem's museum, and the next one will be on blood.
Blood. Okay, I have a painting I made with blood and with a knife into a heart, so I'll send it to you. I'm very interested to know how you work with the things on the opposite side. Do you show Polish culture influenced by Jews, not only Jews being influenced by Polish culture? Do you particularly take a subject and focus on it? Let's say something within the Polish cuisine, or something within Polish, let's say, music or whatever, but showing it from the Polish side. I know it's a Jewish museum, you have to show it from the Jewish side maybe more, but isn't it interesting just as much for Polish people to know, oh, this we do this way because there were Jews here and we've been absorbing some of their way of living, some of their way of thinking.
First of all, you know, when two groups live close to each other, the borderlines, which group influenced which one and whose dishes they were, it's hard to put. But of course, if you mention cooking, as it's always a nice subject and people like to eat, like to taste new things, we have a place called Menorah. It's a place which has a part of open, it's like a restaurant cafeteria more. And part of it is also dedicated to cooking classes. And for those cooking classes, we invite different chefs who present different parts of different aspects of Jewish cuisine. One is Ashkenazi, but it might be Sephardi, it might be an Israeli, and people can sign in for those courses, and they're really popular.
Oh,
so people
nice.
Enjoy, you know, having that not only knowledge, but having that on their own experience. So they can try, they can prepare, they can take recipes. So if we come into this popular culture and food, and for example, if we organize picnics and open festivals, it's always popular to present recipes like how to prepare challah, because people know challah, and then they'd realize that challah is a dish which is used in Jewish homes.
That's what I meant.
Yes,
yeah, exactly.
So then they find, okay, if they find, for example, kugel, they reflect, okay, that's something similar we have, or gefilte fish. So that's a way to present that those nations that were that close, that they were influencing, and the dishes were interweaving in between two groups, right? Which right. were neighbors, and the borders were not always that clear.
Yeah. Look, I just read a book, not in Polish though, but from a Polish Jewish writer. Mm-hmm. And I've been wondering how come and why all those very famous Jewish Polish writers, one of them that received even the Nobel Prize, are forgotten or not really read so much. I went to the library here and I asked for a particular writer. They didn't even hear about him, and he's a popular one. At last I found a book, and it was Bruno Schulz. Mm-hmm. What do you do about the Polish literature, Sienkiewicz and Bruno Schulz and so many others who influenced Polish literature? What do you do about them? Isn't it a very important part of Polish culture?
Mm-hmm. I mean,
not many even know that they were Jewish. One of like Bruno Schulz.
So, of course, you might find Bruno Schulz in the exhibit itself.
And Raimund.
That I don't. I would not say whether he's on the exhibit itself. But as for the writers,
is it a difficult issue to take up in a museum where you have to be very visual? Is it because of that?
We have a part in our exhibit dealing with languages. It's the end of the 19th century gallery and beginning of 20th century, and we present the differences between Hebrew, which started to be a spoken language at the end of 19th century, Yiddish as a language which not was only the spoken language, but started to be also the literature mm-hmm. language, and Polish. And then we present different authors who wrote and tried to develop those languages as the language of Jews and being presented as their own culture, because they wanted to express in that particular language. So that's the part where you can present that Jews were speaking different languages, and they were using us as an expression of their own identity, depending which was closer to them. And that's how we deal it. It's part of the exhibit. Of course, it's a nice idea maybe to have the paths dedicated to the Jewish authors and the complications of languages, and as a way to present their identity and the way which is closer to them, as the language reflects the part of the identity you want to express.
I'm very happy if I gave you an idea to make an exhibition about Raimund or Bruno Schulz. My pleasure. Mm-hmm. I'll do my best to make a big PR work for it then. So when we talk about language, let's talk a little bit about Yiddish mm-hmm. in Poland, which was the center of the language for Jews, and they spoke Yiddish in Russia, in Romania, in many parts of what we consider the eastern part of Europe, but Poland was the center with the Litauen as well. Mm-hmm. But you see, I went on your homepage, and I saw this special selection of Yiddish newspapers shown in your museum. What is the reaction of people of Polish people coming and seeing this very rich culture as a kind of something on a wall? literature has been written in it. Theater, a lot of theater, a lot of movies. 1910, 1920s is the Renaissance of Yiddish movies, Yiddish theater. How do you present it, and what is the reaction? Because it has been killed during World War II. Mm-hmm. It's nearly eliminated because of the Holocaust. But it's kind of a revival right now. Mm-hmm. Revival in the United States, revival in England, in Israel, even in Europe, Scandinavia. So how will you, how do you present it? What is the reaction? I'm very keen on it because Yiddish was such an essential part of Jewish culture in Poland. And by showing it, maybe something can be revived of empathy, of sympathy to the Jewish culture in Poland. What is what I think. Mm-hmm. Is this the way you work with it too? Or what is the strategy of your museum regarding Jewish Yiddish culture? Is there any strategy?
I don't think that there is any strategy, as far as I know. But you have to remember that for most of the Poles, Yiddish as language does not say to them anything. So you have to start from the beginning, explaining what was it. Was it because they know only something they call Jewish language, whatever it is. But they have no clue whether it's Hebrew or
okay.
It sounds like German a bit. So really what you have to start
with... It's like Chinese to me.
Yes, because it's in a foreign culture for them.
Yeah.
So if you have a 13-year-old teenager coming to the museum, you have to really start from the beginning saying that was the Jewish language was a daily language spoken by the Ashkenazi Jews. Ashkenazi Jews were the Jews who lived. The language started to be created on the basis of Hebrew and the German language. It's simplifying, because if you put too much, then they will get nothing. And then the question is, but why it's written in such a strange letter? Really, you have to present the basics.
From point one.
And then you start, it was a daily language for thousands of years of the Jews who lived here. But then it started at the 19th century to be treated as a national language. So then, really basics, because if you start to put a huge, like, overwhelming information that there was a whole culture, but whole culture of what?
Look, it sounds to me, in a way, if I may just tell you my impression, mm-hmm. It sounds to me as if there is a war, has been a war until recently, between the history of Poland, not Polish Jews, Poland as general, where you didn't tell your people, where you didn't explain to them the whole complex of this Polish society where Jews were such an important part of it. It's as if I listen to you and I feel, you know, like a cold wall between what was and what was just here very few years ago, and a population that is absolutely not aware of what was. And now you have to start all over again from 0.0. Which gives me a kind of a chill, I may say. It gives me a chill, and I'm honest with you, because my roots in Poland are 1,000 years old. And I'm evaporated with the air concerning the Polish population. And it hurts me.
Mm-hmm.
I hope your museum can do something about it.
Mm-hmm. It's like, as far as I understood, you have to keep in mind that after the war, Poland was changed completely, not only by the war, but by the political system. The political system oppressed the memory and also manipulated the memory in that sense that did not enable the pre-war story to be presented, also the war story. So it's not like people wanted to forget, but it was also an oppression from the Communist Party. And it's only 20 years that Poland gained the independence. So there was a vacuum. That was a vacuum that if you took a school book from 50s or 60s, there was no, almost no word about Jews. Jews were treated as Poles. Yes, you couldn't read in Auschwitz, there were no Jewish victims perishing in the Holocaust. They were citizens of Poland. So it's not like Poles wanted to forget and then they just diminished the idea of their neighbors, but it was strictly manipulated by the ruling power, and it's the consequence. So I think we cannot blame the 13-year-old boy who has never seen, and it's also already a third generation,
second generation. I don't blame. Mm-hmm. I just make a kind of conclusion.
But it is a reality. He or she is growing up in a small town, whatever, Szczebrzeszyn. And without somebody helping him to understand the complexity of those relations, he can't just invent it by himself. So that's why I have to also mention one important project of the museum. It's called Museum on Wheels. It's a project of a cube where we present a story of 1,000 Polish Jewish history in a temporary exhibit which travels from one town to the other. What is important is the reception, the local reception of that temporary exhibit, and the whole educational program and cultural program being added to that traveling exhibit, because then it's the way to expose this forgotten history, to start speaking about it. Because you do not have to bring all those people to the museum, because you come to them. So they are welcoming you, but in a way, it's the way to come to their homes, because you are in the middle of the small town, saying, you see, there were the neighbors, what has happened with that complex history? And for many of them, it's something completely new. But also, it's the way to reveal the forgotten past, so their grandchildren, their grandfathers came, who maybe were born after the war already, but they still keep the memories of their grandparents. And that's how the story is being revealed. So I think that's a huge impact by these local activists, which we try to encourage for their own programs to reveal the story. Otherwise, you know, the centralized institution can't do that. We have to find partners. We call them ambassadors. They are teachers, they are local activists who do that job there. And we try to support them different ways, giving the trainings, the courses, inviting them to the museums, giving the, you know, methodological support. Because it's like, it's work from the scratch sometimes.
Yeah, that's what I meant. You start from point zero. Well, that sounds interesting. Very interesting. Should we have music now again and have a break for a couple of minutes? We'll have music and...
Tanzen al hazidim
Yes, and my guest in the studio is Kamila Dombrowska, manager of the guides unit in on the Museum Pauline in Warsaw. Welcome again, and we continue Hello. Our very interesting conversation about the different aspects of having a Jewish museum in Poland. Just to sum up, maybe we should even mention what kind of concert you have today at the museum.
Yes, I realize that I'm missing that concert. It's the Kronos Quartet from San Francisco. It's a violinist troupe, really widely recognized all over the world. Also playing the traditional Jewish music, being interpreted in the, of course, modern version. They are top rank musicians.
And you wanted to be there.
Yes, but I'm in Denmark.
I think you should even be happy. Yes. You can always go on the YouTube.
Yes. But it's like, as we spoke before about the Jewish artists which are invited to the museum, it's the proof that the museum is also a platform for the top-ranked Jewish artists from all over the world to play their own concerts, to present art. And I think it's a huge success that we have that possibility.
Sure.
And we can present a Jewish contemporary culture being part of the worldwide recognized culture.
Sure.
So next time they play concert, please come to us.
Next time they play concert, we will be aware of not inviting you to Radio Shalom. All right. Now, all what you told about your programs and what your plans are, it sounds fantastic. In Denmark anyway, such a program, such a variety of subjects and such a variety of intentions will be nearly impossible because of the lack of economical means. Now, who is contributing so you can do it? It's impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have private contributions? Do you have official or who, if they are, who are they?
So the regular work of the museum, so our salaries, they are covered by the Ministry of Culture. So that's the basics. Without that, we can't really function, and the building would be not possible to function. That's a that's a Polish state, which makes it possible to function. But for additional programs, of course, we have to raise money. And we managed to get a Norwegian grant for 6 million zloty, which enabled us to have free educational courses for Polish schools, but also an educational activity for teachers, but also other activities, cultural, also the collecting of oral histories of those Polish Jews who are eager to give us the interviews. So different layers of museum's activity was possible to develop due to that Norwegian funds. And they were, we did it really good. So the evaluation of the programs which were covered by Norwegian grants were really highly ranked by Norwegians. So we are trying to get the next grant, which is crucial for us as the educational activity, which enables the normal regular school and pupils will always not have money to come to attend our classes and to they visit the core exhibit. Also the teachers, as I mentioned, and also museum of wills. So this work on really scratch, it was possible due to this contribution. So we hoped that it will continue. Otherwise, we try to find money. As in the museum, as for example, I'm responsible also for the courses for policemen and teachers related with anti-discrimination issues. And what we do, we use our core exhibit to teach about the mechanism of discriminating the groups. And for that, we have to raise money, and we are applying for the European Union funds. So it's a work on trying to raising money.
Like other museums,
yes,
in the world,
yes,
and in Europe. But establishing the museum itself, it was a big American contribution. there were contributions from several countries. Is this something continuing, or do you have to raise every time a new attention to your programs, like the one you just mentioned?
Mm-hmm. The museum was possible to be built due to this private state kind of coalition. So part of the money we're giving from the Polish state, and due to that we were able to build the building. And for the core exhibit was where money collected from the private donors, states, like the huge amount of money came at the beginning from Germany. It enabled the whole process to start with. And we were raising money.
I would say, really, wouldn't you expect that after what happened? Yes, I will.
So the money came also from Germany, but we were raising, I mean, the Association of Jewish Institutes, they were raising money all over the world, also among the American Jews, of course. But also the Polish businessmen were giving money for the museum to be built for the core exhibit. So
it was a collaboration between private and official resources.
Yes.
Okay. Correct. I'm very interested to know now more about what you're going to do about the 68 program, mm-hmm. which is your responsibility.
Yeah.
And I'd like very much you to tell the idea and the way you think you can contribute to understanding what is happening. Mm-hmm. What happened there?
What happened there? So first of all, we are preparing the temporary exhibit, which will be open on the 8th of March, so the symbolic date which started the whole anti-Semitic campaign in Poland, 3rd of March 2018, and it will be open till the end of September 2018. The exhibit itself will, as I told at the beginning, trying to explain the whole complex or events which happened in that period, to let the Polish visitor understand what March 68 was for Jews. As we stress the fact that Jewish experience is at the core of that that particular exhibit. So you are presenting the Jewish life in before, because for many it was not that, it's not obvious that Jews were living in Poland till the end of 1960s, a relatively large number, of course nothing to compare with what was before the war, but still there were a couple of thousands people living here. So we try to present that part of the story, and then to put it in a broader context, what end of 70s was for Europe, for Poland, and for world, to let understand that all those factors made happen the anti-Semitic campaign in Poland. In the heart of the exhibit, there will be a train station as a symbol of leaving the country and going somewhere, being expelled as a transition point. Because you leave the country and the last place you see is the railway station. Now it's also an airport, but at that time was a railway station. What will be new for sure for our visitors is that we want to present also the story after they came to their new fatherlands, motherlands, sometimes only called hostlands. So the story after they left Poland.
Do you know how many left Poland in numbers?
Yes, it's about 13,000. It's estimated by historians that about 13,000 left Poland.
And all were regarded as refugees. Did they all get the same status where they came to?
No.
No.
It depends where they when they came, where they came.
So, but they were legally expelled, right?
They were deprived of the citizenship. So the moment when they decided to leave, automatically they were given the document claiming that they are not more citizens of Poland.
But at the same time, automatically don't they become refugees according to the United Nations?
No, because if they, for example, emigrated to Israel, they automatically get the Israeli citizenship.
No, okay, but Israel is a special...
But it was also a huge part of...
Okay.
I mean, relatively, about 2,000-3,000 people came to Israel.
All right.
And they were given automatically the
citizenship yes. there, of yeah. course, yes.
It lasted longer here, as we know. In Denmark, it took few years to get the permanent citizenship.
The people that left Poland or were expelled of that time, could they themselves choose where they want to go to, or were they just expelled and then whatever happened, nobody would took really care?
No, usually people have been deciding at the moment they decided to leave where they would go. Some they were choosing Israel because they had families.
Sure.
They wanted to be citizens at the moment. They said, like, when they tell me why they have chosen Israel, because we wanted to have their own country, to be treated as a full right citizens, and nobody in the future will tell me you are not anymore welcome. And Israel gave that chance.
Sure, because Israel is giving automatically
yes,
citizenship
Aliyah,
to
yes.
anybody that yes. has Jewish roots. Okay, so but they could choose wherever they wanted to go afterward. Those who were not going to Israel.
Not necessarily, because America was not inviting everybody. You had to get invited by, for example, by particular people who claim that they will cover your expenses, they will help you, or sometimes Jewish communities were supporting the immigrants, and sometimes United States were not inviting those people who were really involved in the communist system, because they at that time there was this paranoia of anti-communistic. But Scandinavia was the wildest open, apart of Israel, so they were...
So most maybe immigrated or came to the Scandinavian countries?
I would say that equal number, it's hard to really count it, because nobody did, and no historian did this particular counting at that precise amount. But the same, more or less the same number came to Denmark, and more or less the same number came to Sweden, and more or less the same number came to Israel.
So this is the story you're going to tell at the exhibition.
Part of that will present that story, that people had to choose where to live, and they had been choosing due to the different factors, the new place on earth they will leave.
And the ones that didn't choose Israel, why did they choose some other places? Because of what? What were the considerations? Economically, politically, what were the considerations? Mm-hmm.
You are right. One of the reasons was an economic, because the possibilities to find work. The Scandinavian countries give them a huge support, helping them really to set down their lives from nothing. And it was something...
Nice you say from nothing, because this is something not many people are conscious about.
Mm-hmm.
That when you are expelled, you leave
nothing.
With nothing.
Nothing. You come with a suitcase with the tons of things which are not necessarily useful in the country you come. And so one was economic. One reason, I think it's better to ask, of course, those ones who live here, why did they choose Denmark?
Well, but maybe you have some kind of information
yes.
already now.
So that's what I'm what they are telling me. The other reason was that it was close to Poland. Some people had still their parents living there, and it was the moment, you know, this notion that we might still come, we might somehow be closer. Israel felt, you know, really far away. And the other reason was, it was after the Six-Day War. And they, of course, they did not know, but Yom Kippur War came soon after. So they knew that this political situation is not really stable. And you know, after...
Not only political, but security as well.
Yes, and you have to keep in mind that it was only 20 years after the Holocaust, so not everybody wanted to risk their lives and their children's lives. So Israel was not that obvious in the sense of security.
So this is the background you will focus on when you plan the exhibitions.
We want to present the Polish context, of course, the moment of expulsion and the decisions, because we also want to present those ones who stayed and why they stayed. What reasons made those
few thousand? Yes, very interesting. Why did they stay? Why did they stay while their Jewish fellowships were expelled?
What kind of identity they had at that moment?
Yes. And could they stay in a way they were?
What has happened with them?
Yes, that's what I mean.
What has happened with them when the moment you lose part of your world and you have to build it? And even though you did not really feel Jewish, but then in 68 you were pointed out as Jew.
Very important point too, because many didn't know they were Jews.
Correct.
And somebody was they are here around in Copenhagen, sometimes they tell their story. And some told me, and you're probably aware of it just as well, they were asked to come to the chief master of the school or the academy, wherever they were, and they were told, you're not a pupil here anymore. Mm-hmm. And they would say, why am I not a pupil? I didn't do anything. I'm a very successful pupil. Oh, but you're Jewish. So, no, I'm not Jewish. Yes, you are. Go home to your mother and ask her. Then you'll get to know it. And these stories are very important to tell, I think.
Yes, and they're really emotional, because then it's all issue of destroying your identity, being, you know, at the exact moment being, you know, pointed out by somebody, and then the whole world changes. And you have everything destroyed around you. And what? You have to build it from nothing.
Well, for some people, I will not say many, anyway, for mm-hmm. some people, it destroyed totally their future, their professional future, because mm-hmm. it was abrupted in the middle of maybe an education, in the middle of establishing oneself. So these aspects of what it means to expel people, I think, is very important to focus on.
Yes, and especially that Europe is facing those problems and issues right now, and then we have new groups, and now we are inviting them, not inviting, treating them as foreigners. We are not that open anymore as certain countries were at the end of 70s.
But don't you think it is because it's not, how to say, it's rather important what kind of people you invite into your country. Mm-hmm. It's rather important what kind of people are expelled from, let's say, that time in Poland. And the background, their cultural background is very important. Isn't it an issue to take into consideration?
Yes, but the politics, the being open or being closed as a state for foreigners has changed since then. So, of course, that's one aspect, as you mentioned, you might consider or might not, but you cannot put everybody into one box and say you are not welcome because you are a foreigner, or you claim that you...
No, of course not. Mm. I will never say that. But what has proved since these Polish Jews came to Denmark, they have integrated beautifully into the mm. Danish society. Their children are just as the other Danish people around it, the other Danish children around them. They are a part of the Danish society. They are their identity is Danish. They are aware of their roots, but they have been able to be part of a society and contribute on a very high level too, mm-hmm. which is a success story for many of them who came to Denmark.
Correct.
And I assume the same is in Sweden and in Norway as well.
Mm-hmm.
So what I wanted to just check with you is, are there any literary contribution from these people? Their art, their literature, their whatever kind of expression. Is there any evidence of what happened in art from these people? Have you collected anything? Are you collecting anything?
We are now trying to collect the materials for the exhibit. We're still more than a year ahead. So we are now in the process of curators are working on the content of exhibit. And one part of the exhibit will be dedicated to an art related with the March 68 event. So yes, they do the research on that issue, trying to put the narrative coherent and to present the art pieces which might reflect with the whole narration of the exhibit. But yes, there will be a part dedicated to art.
Because you see, this is still for me personally, not a mysterium, but anything I've anyway, something I've been looking for. I cannot see it here in Denmark. The impression it had made on artistic in the artistic way. I'm still looking for and seeking the artistic signs of people's heartaches, of people's problems, connecting to being expelled, connecting of being suddenly identified as Jews in a negative way. I'm lacking the music of it, the art of it, the literature of it. I'm lacking the emotion expressed. Maybe it's too early, but I'm doubting if it's too early, because these people are now 70, 80 years old. It's the last second to ask them to express it, maybe. But until now, I have not been aware that this is the case, that they have given expression emotionally through art of what they've been through.
I think it's a good question for us. Maybe we can ask Radio Shalom to help us, because...
Well, we'll do our best. We know several of these people.
Artists, yes. We know probably Gabriel Levitt, who also...
For example, yes.
And he creates song in Polish, which is really important because it's...
I have invited him for our last dancing party, by the way, and asked him to sing and play for us. And I love his music.
Emotional.
Very emotional, very fantastic. And he creates it all the time. And I've been looking for people like this and their creations. So if your exhibition could show it, maybe this could be even shown other countries as well. Because this is the refugees' art, which is very touching. And in Israel, you have many places where you can see it, and it's natural that, of course, in Israel, the art of the survivors or refugees, Jewish refugees, is there all the time, everywhere. But in other countries, it could be very nice if something from your museum could be, regarding this, could be shown other places.
That's an idea. Yes, I think it's worth considering, because it's, you know, touches the soul and present the emotions in that way that it can be understood by the others, not only by speaking and expressing it verbally, but also in attachment to an artistic...
Because you can understand things intellectually, but when you begin to understand them...
Emotionally,
That's the toughest way, but correct. It's the best way to explain other people's emotions.
So I would be grateful for any contacts if we know people who are doing it, even though they are not doing it publicly, but they might do it by themselves, for themselves, to... treat the trauma, because it's the way also to treating and dealing with traumatic events.
Exactly.
So I would be grateful. Thank you.
I will not forget you. All right. Kamila Dombrowska, thank you for contributing
with
your knowledge. I know I have put you sometimes in questions maybe more emotional than I intended to, but we get emotional when you talk about our roots. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us. Thank you very much.
Ja, tak til Øjvind, Mette og Sjanne. Forløbig, vi håber, vi kan lyde lidt gavn af jer igen, for det giver varmen, skulle jeg hilse at sige. Men velkommen til Anders Jericho.
Tak skal du have. Jeg kan ikke se noget som helst andet end en masse flotte fakler. Det er dejligt. Jeg er nødt til at sige... jeg er nødt til at sige noget om form. Fordi at, det har kørt rundt i hovedet på mig hele dagen, at amerikanerne i går valgte en præsident, som har latterliggjort handicappede og lagt latinoamerikanere for had og kaldt et særligt religiøst mindretal for en trussel imod USA. Alligevel forsøgte han at sige her i morges, at han vil være alle amerikaneres præsident. Det giver os to muligheder. Enten har han allerede fortrudt, hvad han har sagt, eller også opfatter han slet ikke latinoerne, de handicappede og muslimerne, USA's 2 millioner muslimer, som rigtige amerikanere. Jeg synes, det her minder mig om et eller andet, vi kender herhjemmefra. Vi ofte hører vi også politikere herhjemme snakke om danskerne. Danskerne skal et eller andet. Danskerne skal vi vise et eller andet hensyn til, eller vi skal sikre det danske, ja, danskerne et eller andet. Hvor pokker kommer det fra? Jeg tror virkelig, det kommer fra en helt anden debat, som netop ikke handler om inklusion, men snarere handler om at sondre mellem danskere, som har rettigheder, og danskere, som skal tages hensyn til, og så nogle andre, der åbenbart ikke hører til danskerne, og som ikke har de samme rettigheder. Så vi har de her to grupper i Danmark. Danskerne, og så de andre, som ikke hedder noget, de er bare nogle andre. Og alligevel ikke helt, fordi vi hører ofte politikere af en vis karakter at snakke om hensynet til danskerne i en sammenhæng, som antyder, at det ikke er modsætning i form af tyskere eller nordmænd, de tænker på. Hvorfor så? Jo, det er næsten altid, når de snakker om danskerne og muslimerne, eller vi hører også nogle gange om danskerne og jøderne, vi hører om romerne, vi hører om sådan særlige andre grupper, som udmærker sig ved ikke altid at høre til danskerne. Jeg vil indrømme dem med det samme, at det kan være en dårlig vane. Vi må jo være tilgivende, selvfølgelig kan det være en dårlig vane, men jeg synes netop for årsdagen for krystalnatten, så er vi også nødt til at tænke på, at det er risikoen ved at hænge mindretal og grupper af mindretal ud. Fordi vi lever i en tid med generalisering, nærmest en generaliseringernes højtid. Og jeg synes, vi lyver for os selv, hvis vi ser bort fra, at der er politiske kræfter, som gerne vil gøre en forskel på dem og os, på danskerne og nogle andre. Og der er politikere, som bevidst dyrker at mistænkeliggøre særlige borgere ved at anfægte deres danskhed. Selvom de taler vores sprog, selvom de er vokset op i vores land, selvom de har gået i vores skole, og selvom de i hver juridisk form hører til gruppen af danskere, så anfægter man deres danskhed. Men hvorfor er det egentlig, at vi vil anfægte eller mistænkeliggøre disse menneskers danskhed? Hvorfor tale om en gruppe, hvis man kunne sætte navn på en konkret mistænkelig, hvis man har grund til at mistænke en person for noget? Det er jo det, som fortidens nazisme eller fascisme i virkeligheden bestod af, at man ikke så menneskene som enkelte personer, men at man insisterede på at se dem som grupper, som var til fare for det øvrige fællesskab. Min påstand vil være, at det er meget ubehageligt og dødsensfarligt at generalisere en gruppe af mennesker på den måde, og at mistænkeliggøre dem over en blok. Et enkelt menneske kan rense sig for injurier. En gruppe af mennesker kan vanskeligt kræve sig renset, men den enkelte i gruppen vil alligevel være mistænkeliggjort. I dag er det moderne at være for ytringsfrihed, og vi står også her, fordi vi er for ytringsfrihed. Det må vel siges at være udmærket, fordi der er alt for mange i verden, der ikke har ytringsfrihed. Det undrer mig alligevel, at der er mange stærkt fordomsfulde herhjemme. Nogle af bærerne af den her diskussion om dem og os, som hører til de stærkeste fortalere for ytringsfrihed. De vil have afskaffet racismeparagraffen. Og egentlig vil jeg også synes, det var dejligt at kunne være så tryg ved harmonien i vores land, at vi kunne afskaffe alle de her paragraffer. Men jeg bliver alligevel en anelse tøvende, når det er nogle af de mest fordomsfulde, som beder om at blive fri for racismeparagrafen og fri for enhver risiko for at blive gjort ansvarlig for hate speech. De vil have frit spil, og jeg forstår ikke, hvorfor de vil have frit spil. Ytringsfrihed betyder jo ikke, at alle ytringer er lige gode. Ytringsfrihed betyder heller ikke, at racisme er lige så godt som tolerance. Ytringsfrihed betyder ikke, at hate speech er lige så godt som hensyn. For ytringsfrihed giver ikke mindre ansvar. Tværtimod, ytringsfrihed må give mere personligt ansvar. Og hvis vi skal slippe nogle af de paragraffer, som trods alt holder fast ved nogle normer for, hvordan vi taler til hinanden, så skal det være i det øjeblik, vi er parat til at stå fast på, at vi alle sammen tager hensyn til hinanden, i stedet for at hænge hinanden ud. Og i mine øjne, så lyver vi for os selv, hvis vi siger, at muslimer, eller romærer, eller jøder, eller flygtninge, eller indvandrere, ved forskellige lejligheder, hvis vi lyver for os selv, hvis vi hævder, at de ikke oplever racisme og hate speech. For racisme og fordomme findes også her. Antisemitisme findes også her i Danmark. Og i virkeligheden er det jo grotesk, at møder om ytringsfrihed, som det vi holder her, skal politibeskyttes. Det er dejligt, og det er trygt, og vi vil sige tak til de betjente, der gør det. Men det er jo grotesk, at møder om ytringsfrihed skal politibeskyttes. Og det er tragisk, at jødisk liv og jødiske institutioner i København skal politibeskyttes. Politiet står jo ikke foran de adresser, fordi at der er jøder. Politiet står der, fordi forrygte mennesker truer nogle af folkene i gaden. Det er ikke et jødisk problem, men det er et problem for jøder. Men er det noget, vi skal tage os af? Ja, det synes jeg, det er. Holocaust kom jo ikke af sig selv, som både Hans og Özlem har talt om. Holocaust og krystallen af det skete, blandt andet fordi, at mennesker lod det ske. Det havde mange forklaringer, men en af forklaringerne var netop, at naboer og landsmænd og mennesker i gaden, som skulle være solidariske, ikke var det. Krystallnatten var en folkelig manifestation, hvor folk havde ikke sagde fra. I morges så jeg en amerikansk kommentator på CNN sige til en af Trumps folk, at han havde svært ved at forklare sine børn, hvad der nu er sket i USA. Han sagde i det her nyhedsprogram i 60'erne i morges, vi opdrager vores børn til, at de ikke skal opføre sig som bøller, og at de ikke skal vise ringeagt over for andre. Og så spurgte han, hvordan skal jeg så forklare mine børn, at vi i USA har valgt Donald Trump? Det handler om at sige fra, når mindretal hænges ud, når naboer, medborgere og skrøbelige mindretal mistænkeliggøres. Det gælder i USA, men det gælder også i Danmark, det var det, jeg ville sige.
Bravo!
Vi er blevet bedt om at underholde lidt, inden at tale. Den første tale kommer. Og det gør vi med en sang, vi faktisk er blevet bedt om at spille her i dag. For det ikke hele skal være spas og ballade. En sang, jeg har skrevet melodi til, som bygger på et digt, som jeg fandt i en sangbog, en jiddisch sangbog, som hedder Es scheint. Og ordene er, es scheint die Sonnenschein wieder durch Tränen scheint das Glück. Og det er faktisk en overlevende fra Auschwitz, der har skrevet dette her digt, og jeg synes, det er fantastisk, at han stadig har håb efter at have siddet i så lang tid. Og det betyder simpelthen, at det skinner, solen skinner gennem tårerne, og håbet findes stadig. Thank you. Aften til hun aften tøje. Søgen genug, genug det trøje. Von flanen spænd, at sin de frei. At sin de frei. Von de dunkels, von de leche, wären mir als von ihm mecke. Weil mir Sorgen am Geschwür, am Geschwür hat. Der Schein, die Sonne scheint wieder, doch drinnen scheint das Glück. Zum Leben, Schwester, Brüder, wir kennen sich zu dir. Es scheint, die Sonne scheint wieder, hier die Schlosser nicht verstummt. Es scheint, doch Tränen scheint das Glied. Wird uns Leben und der mit Azicken geben, wären mir das als was ist, als was ist vorbei. Erscheint die Sonne schon wieder, doch Tränen scheint es geht. Zum Leben, Schwester, Brüder, wir kennen. Scheint, die Sonne scheint wieder, hier die Schlosser nicht verstummt. Es scheint, doch Tränen scheint das Glied.
Foreløbig tak til Janne Nussbaum-banen. God aften og velkommen. Mit navn er John Ingeberg Jacobsen. Jeg er formand for Byggefagenes Samvirke i København. Og jeg skal på vegne af Krystalnats initiativ byde jer alle sammen velkommen til dette års markering af Krystalnatten den 9. november 1938. Vi kommer til at høre mere til Janne og kompagni senere i aften. Men lad mig indledningsvis sige, Krystalnats initiativ er partipolitisk uafhængig, og vi henter vores opbakning blandt antiracistiske foreninger, flygtningevenner, faglige organisationer og interesseforeninger mod diskrimination. I år er det 23. gang, vi afholder en fakkeldemonstration med manifestation her på pladsen. Det sker af to grunde. Dels for at holde fast i vores fælles forståelse af, hvad der skete denne dag i 1938 i Tyskland og Østrig, nemlig det systematiske, organiserede nazistiske overgreb på jøder og jødisk ejendom. Det var ikke første gang, jøderne oplevede nazisternes vold og undertrykkelse, men det blev den begivenhed, der kom til at stå som startskud på de uhyrligheder, som siden førte til mord og udryddelse i KZ-lejrene. Vi holder også manifestationen af en anden grund, nemlig forståelse af den historiske udvikling af nazisternes udryddelsespolitik. Det kan ikke stå alene. Og for at vise, det kan lade sig gøre og forhindre noget lignende i at gentage sig.
men det forudsætter, at vi forholder os til de tendenser og strømninger i vores dage, som kan føre til en gentagelse. Gør vi det ikke nu, er det fare for, at historien kan blive aktuel igen, og det må ikke ske. Formålet med dette arrangement har alle år været at sætte fokus på diskrimination og racisme. Det er det, vi er forenet om i dag. Vi er ikke samlet om en fælles stillingtagen til alle mulige konflikter rundt i verden i øvrigt, hvad enten det er Venezuela, Ukraine, Mellemøsten eller Hongkong. Hvis man er enig i vores borgerlige og grundlag, er man velkommen her, og hvad man i øvrigt mener om verden, er ens private sag. For nylig viste en undersøgelse blandt unge, at der var overraskende tilslutning til, at muslimer ikke skal have samme ytringsfrihed som andre her i landet. Det er naturligvis helt forkert, udemokratisk og skræmmende. For hvis man gennemfører en sådan politik, så holder man mindretal ude, og man fratager mindretallet et grundlæggende redskab i demokratiet. Sådanne holdninger er naturligvis helt uacceptable og farlige. For hvem bliver de næste, der skal have indskrænket deres ytringsfrihed? Under nazismen så man jo præcis, hvad det kan føre til, hvis man fjerner bestemte gruppers rettigheder. Så fjernes det demokratiske grundlag for samfundet, og så åbnes banen for politiske kræfter, som i deres yderste konsekvens må føre til undertrykkelse, mere vold og mord, hvis frasættelsen af ytringsfriheden skal opretholdes. Derfor har vi som tema for vores manifestation sat forsvaret af ytringsfriheden. Ingen skal fratages den demokratiske ret til at give udtryk for sin mening og holdning, heller ikke selv, om man kan være nok så uenig i, hvad det bliver sagt. Igen i år er vi glade for at have Hans Goldstein på programmet. Det har han været i mange år efterhånden, og det er der en god grund til. For Hans oplevede som ung jødisk mand i Østrig krystalnatten i sin hjemby i Wien. Han blev offer for de forbrydelser, som nazisterne udsatte den jødiske befolkning for. Og nogen kunne måske spørge, hvorfor blev ved med at berette om dengang? Er det ikke på tide at se fremad og lægge redslerne for dengang bag os? Hvis bare det var så vel. Sådan er det ikke. Kigger man ud over Europa i dag, så sker der bekymrende ting, som må vække enhver borger. Se på Grækenland, hvor højre ekstremistiske kræfter er stærkt repræsenteret i parlamentet. Se på Ungarn og andre lande i Central- og Østeuropa. Og bemærk, hvordan mindretal hetses og forfølges. Hans Goldsteins historie er vigtig at fortælle igen og igen, fordi det er beretning om, hvad krystalnatten i 1938 blev begyndelsen på, nemlig udryddelseslejre og massemord. Så vidt er vi ikke i dag, heldigvis, men uden vilje til at sige fra i ord og handling, er der kun få stopklodser på vejen til en moderne gentagelse af disse grusomheder. Efter Hans har været på, så taler Özlem Cekic, debattør og brobygger, journalist Anders Jerrigaard og Leif Søndergaard fra Dansk Musikforening. Og indimellem får vi som sagt mulighed for at høre mere musik af Sianne og orkester. Arrangementet er naturligvis ikke gratis at afholde. Det kommer ikke som en overraskelse, så derfor sælger vi fakler til 20 kroner stykket hernede. I må meget gerne aftale penge. Og når de er brændt ud, så over ved lampen står der en stor sandkasse, hvor I kan slukke dem. Og så skal vi hilse at sige, at mens vi står her, tændes der tusinder af fakler ved krystalnats arrangementer i mere end 100 byer rundt i Europa. Så lad os tænde en ekstra fakkel for dem. Og værsgo, Hans.
Til den jødiske påske hedder det, at det var pligt at fortælle om udgangen fra Egypten. Noget, der sker for langt over 3000 år siden i en præhistorisk tid. Og det gør vi. Så måske derfor føler jeg mig dobbelt forpligtet til at fortælle om noget, der skete for kun 78 år siden. Den 9. og 10. november 1938. Og der er heller ikke mange tilbage, som kan optræde som øjenvidner og kan tegne et billede om hændelsen i krystalnatten. Det er forresten efterhånden trængsel, hvad der den 9. november skal huskes på. I mit barndom var det dagen, den første verdenskrig sluttede i 1918. Senere krystalnatten, som vi holder højtidlig i dag, og til sidst Berlinmurens fald for 27 år siden, begivenheder, som måske fortrænger mindet om Kristallnatten, men jeg kan da se, at der kommer stadig en bunke mennesker, som deltager i mindesundet. Det er gået mere end 97 år siden, at jeg blev født i Wien. Vi var en varm og kærlig familie, yderst velintegreret. Ja, mine forældre og vi tre børn var så at sige wienere med stor W. Det hjalp nu ikke ret meget, da Anschluss kom i marts 1938, og Østrig blev det stortyske riges Ostmark. De skrappe lovbestemmelser, som de tyske jøder i løbet af 4 års Hitlerstyrelse blev udsat for, blev gennemført hos os i løbet af 3 måneder, og det skete rabiat og effektivt. Min far, som var tandlæge, måtte efter 1. juli ikke længere behandle ariske patienter. Operationsstolen blev fjernet, selvfølgelig med en folkkvittering. Jøderne kunne sagtens behandles på køkkenstolen. Ja, det betød jo ikke så forfærdeligt meget. Wiens jøder havde andre bekymringer end at forordne deres tænder. Det galt at komme væk, og det så hurtigt som muligt. Men det var sgu lettere sagt end gjort. Alle grænser var lukket for os, som havde et stort løg på passets forside. Og ikke nok med det, så fik vi også en ekstra fornavn. Mændene blev kaldt Israel, og kvinderne Sara. Jeg skal skåne jer for beskrivelse af alle de ydmygelser, vi var udsat for i de første måneder efter Anschluss. Det var, når alt kommer til alt, småting i forhold til det, der kom senere. Man siger, at gamle folk har svært med at huske, hvad der skete i går og i dag forgårs. Og det er der noget om. Men det, der skete i natten mellem den 9. og 10. november 1938 og de dage derefter, det glemmer jeg altså aldrig. Natten, som gik i historien som kristallnat. Lad mig kort fortælle, hvad der egentlig skete. Jødernes situation i Tyskland og specielt i Østrig blev værre og værre i løbet af 1938. 17.000 polske jøder, som havde fast bopæl i Tyskland, skulle sendes til Polen. Men Polen ville ikke lade dem komme ind. Cirka 5.000 af dem havnede i Ingmansland i nærheden af byen Spasching i kulde og sult. Den 18-årige Hirschel Grünspan, som levede illegal i Paris, hørte, at hans forældre var deporteret. Han opsøgte den tyske ambassade i Paris og skød embedsmanden Ernst von Rath. Grünspan blev forresten 1940 af Vichy-regeringen, altså den franske regering, udleveret til tyskerne. Hans skæbne er ubekendt, men der er vel ikke nogen tvivl om, hvad der skete med ham. Denne episode blev tyskerne brugt som forklaring for en nøjagtig planlagt aktion med pogromagtige udskillelser over hele Tyskland. Over 300 synagoger og ca. 200 andre jødiske bygninger gik op i flammer. 25.000 jøder blev arresteret og sendt i koncentrationslejre. 91 blev dræbt. Når brandvæsen blev udkommanderet, var det ikke for at slukke branden, men forhindret, for at ilden skulle brede sig til nabohusene. Tallene for Wien, altså min fødeby, var 42 synagoger, der blev brændt ned, 27 dræbte, 88 hårdt sårede, 90 begik selvmord i nattens løb, 6.500 blev arresteret. Det er 3.700 sendt de dager. Blandt dem var også min far. Göring, Hitlers nummer 2, var meget sur over de mange værdier, der var gået tabt. De skulle have slået flere jøder ihjel.